Thank you. Thanks for this nice introduction. And I will now introduce the ISP Free. So Free, as mentioned, is a French ISP. It has been known since forever to disrupt the market on a regular basis with nice offers, both on the internet access side and the mobile phone access too. It's the first ISP in France to release a set-top box, which is called the Freebox. This set-top box from the beginning enabled triple play, as in internet access, phone, and TV over IP. On the left here, you can see the first versions of the Freebox. In the middle is the version 3 and 4 with a smaller form factor. And the version 5 in 2006 was released as two separate boxes, one for the internet access on the top and one for the TV on the bottom. And that's our device of interest today. So this Freebox, called Freebox HD, released in 2006, comes with a nice form factor, a front panel to display information, and quite some connectivity on the back. So we have here Wi-Fi antennas, TV antennas, inputs, outputs, including HDMI, an Ethernet port, and two USB ports so that we can plug in our USB drives there. The router part acts as a DSL modem, a switch, and a router. It's a bit out of scope of this presentation, but it will make a few appearances. So the main features of the Freebox HD is that it's a PVR, so personal video recorder. It's programmable, it has time shift and a hard drive of 40 gigabytes. And since Free likes geeks, they add nice features to their boxes. And this one has an FTP server, so we can upload videos. We can also download recordings, which is quite nice. The box also runs Doom, so it's possible to play Doom out of the box. We have Duke Nukem 3D as well, and an SDK. And this SDK allows to develop programs which are quite limited, unfortunately. It's limited to an interpreted language and it runs in a sandbox that's heavily restricted. So why would anyone want to hack a box if it already runs Doom? Well, for the second reason, which is they remove features that we like for no good reason. So let me present my use case. My Freebox HD, I had a small crappy screen connected to it, and I used it to record programs, then download them with FTP, and watch them on my PC, which had a much better screen. It's something that I could do with a TV capture card, it would work the same. And then one day, the two main private TV channels in France, TF1 and M6, decided that this is not acceptable. So they asked Free to stop the ability to download programs, recordings through FTP. It was still possible to record them, but not to download them. So I was a bit annoyed because many other channels followed and it was almost impossible to download recordings. But we know that the box has a hard drive, so we can just open it and get the hard drive out. So there are three screws, two visible screws and one below this sticker. And once it's open, it looks like this. After the hard drive is removed, it looks like this. And I will come back to this picture in a bit. But OK, I had the hard drive disconnected. I connected it to my PC. And I decided to do a full dump of the raw data and unplug it as soon as possible. I was afraid to write something and make it unusable. Then I mounted this dump and analyzed it. And there are three partitions on it, which are XFS. Two small partitions, which are encrypted, and I couldn't get anything out of them. And the third partition is not encrypted. It contains the recordings, which are also not encrypted, in a special directory called private records. So you can see that this directory is the only one owned by root. So at this point, I assume that the FTP server just doesn't list files if they are owned by root. Interestingly enough, the other files are owned by user 4242. It seems like at Free, people like the number 42. OK, so this is mission accomplished, right? I could get my recordings, but let's look at before how it used to work. I record a program. I get it with FTP. And after I record the program, I have to open the Freebox HD, remove the hard drive, connect it to a PC, mount it, copy the file, put it back to the Freebox HD. So it's FTP with a lot of extra steps, and I was not really satisfied with that. And I thought it's surely possible to do better, and we can make the private recordings public again. But for that, I need to understand how the PVR program works. And I started with what I had, which was the unencrypted HDD partition. Unfortunately, there was really nothing interesting there. So besides the recordings, it's pure data. There is no configuration file, no binary, nothing that could be reasonably exploited. So the next step is to hack the Freebox, which I consider a good thing. And in addition, if successful, it could unlock Homebrew and potentially many more possibilities. But in all honesty, I had already decided I would hack it, regardless of the recording situation at this point. Okay, so what's in it again? We have here the main CPU and its RAM. We have 128 megabytes of RAM. So I knew there should be some flash memory somewhere, but it was not on this side of the PCB. Later, I learned that it was a 32 megabytes chip. So the next step would be to remove the PCB, inspect the other side, and just desolder the flash and dump it. But there's a slight problem with that. This is not really my box. So technically, and I mean legally, the box really belongs to Free. It's just lent to subscribers. And as far as I know, it's always been like this with Free, and it's still like this. So we never own the box as customers. We just get it, and we have to give it back in working order when we cancel the subscription. So I didn't want to desolder anything or even touch the PCB. Because I had already damaged the sticker at this point, and I decided that I was not going to make any hardware modification. So there is no choice but to have a soft mod. However, to start with a soft mod, we need some kind of entry point, something to begin with. And I had no firmware, no information, so I was starting a blind exploitation. And what's the first step in hacking a device? It's to check if someone else has already done it. So in my case, I did a few Google searches, and I saw that indeed there was a team who had already attempted this. The team was called Open Freebox. So I was never a part of it. I just stumbled upon their website when doing my research. And today the website is down, but still accessible with the Wayback Machine. So they had done quite some work on the Freebox V4, but never really a hack. And the Freebox V5, of which the Freebox HD is, was almost undocumented. There was nothing they had given that was really interesting. So we got this picture of a serial interface on the Freebox HD PCB and the bootlog that they got with it. And if we look at it, it seems as a very early bootlog. There's not much information. The only thing that we can see that could mean something is XAV, Zboot, SMP863X. So nothing really to work with here. But what about Free themselves? Because most of the software on the Freebox HD is GPL, which means that Free has to publish the modification that they do. They are legally obliged to do that. Except that there was a debate, and for some time they didn't, because they argued that the Freebox HD is never the customer's property, so it should be considered as just a node in their internal network. But after a few years, they caved and published the modifications. So by just looking at this, we see that the system on chip is SMP8634, actually, which is a MIPS CPU. It runs Linux 2631 with VisiBox. The Doom software which is used is also mentioned, and it's called PR Boom. It's a Doom source port, so it's the Doom engine, a bit cleaned up, and it can compile for many architectures. There's also libxif, libtimidity, and since the box allows to view pictures, I thought there must be libjpeg and libpng. And these two libraries are known to have many vulnerabilities fixed for almost all of them. And the nice thing is the bug reports often come with sample pictures to trigger the vulnerabilities. However, they are also hugely popular, so the vulnerabilities are fixed, and that's the case also on the Freebox HD, so I was never able to trigger a bug with a picture. I thought about finding a new zero-day vulnerability in one of these libraries, but this was in 2012 and 2011, so quite a while ago, but shortly after Chrome had released. And Google had audited these libraries really to the core, And all the easy vulnerabilities were fixed, and I thought this could be a waste of time. So by the way, this all happened in 2011 and 2012, so quite a while ago, but it's the first time I'm presenting this. So what other entry point do we have? Well, I like game save files, because generally, the game developers, they treat them as trusted data. After all, it's their own game which produced them, and they don't really expect people to modify them manually. And well, this box runs Doom, which is good. We know which version, it's open source, so we even have the source code. And while playing with Doom, I noticed that the way to play Doom is to upload save files and WAT files with the FTP server. So the reason for that is while PRBoom is open source and can be freely distributed, the WAT files, which contains the Doom data, all the assets, all the levels, they are copyrighted, and for example, doom1.wad belongs to id Software. So they had to let the users somehow provide a WAT file for the box to be able to run Doom. So I thought that should be a good entry point and decided to download the source file, the source files, and look at the save algorithm. So the save algorithm is pretty much what you would expect. It copies the player structure to a buffer, and the buffer will be later written to the file. But it also does something with some structure, a psprite state. And the reason for that, so if we look at the player structure, we see that it contains some psprites. And these are sprites used to display the weapon, actually. And the psprite has a state, which is a pointer, and this pointer points to a global states array. So of course, you cannot just write a pointer to a file, because when you load the file, the pointer will be invalid. So what the code does is it converts the pointer into an index into this array. So that's perfectly fine. You just need to do the opposite when the file is loaded. And let's look at both algorithms side by side. So copy the player structure to the buffer, and when you load, you copy from the buffer to the player structure. That's fine. But then, the load algorithm, when it restores the state, it has to take the index and convert it back to a state pointer. And I think some of you may already have spotted the problem here. There is absolutely no check done on the state index before converting it to a pointer. So in theory, if we modify this state index in the save file, we can control the state address and make it point anywhere. This could be good. Let's have a look at what's inside the state and how it's used. So this is the state structure that we can control in theory, and it's really only used in that function, pmove psprites. So if we control the state, then we can control the next state too. The next state is passed to a function psetpsprites as stnum. Stnum is used to load a new state, so we can control that too. The state has an action, and this action is called as a callback. So this looks pretty good. We can probably get some code execution with that. So let me recap quickly how we do that. We have this player structure. It has a state. We modify this state by touching the save file, so it points to some memory that we control too. In this memory, we craft a state T that has a next state, which points to another state T that we also control. And finally, this action pointer will be called. We control it. We make it point to some arbitrary code that we want executed. And it should work. Or should it? We still have two problems to solve. The first one is that the payload will only be executed if its memory is executable. So this is the NX protection. Normally, the CPU will refuse to execute some memory which is not marked as executable. And second, we absolutely have no idea where we should have control of these trucks, at which addresses, where the game loads. We know nothing. So for the first problem, I chose to just ignore it. And because it's a MIP CPU, maybe it doesn't have NX protection. We'll see that later. For the second problem, we need a memory address leak or something. We could use heap spraying to maximize the chances, or maybe we could use both. So let's think a bit more about this and what we can do. If we put in the safe file a completely wrong index, then the pointer that is reconstructed will point to invalid memory and the game will crash. And this we will, of course, we will see it. But if we look at the code of psetpsprite, we see that if we provide a state that is zero, the weapon sprite is completely removed, so the weapon disappears from the game. We have an info leak right here. We know if the game crashes, it means the pointer points to an invalid memory, and if the weapon disappears, the memory is valid and it contains zeros. So that's the theory. I wanted to test it, and since Pyrabom is open source, I just compiled it and run it on my PC. And indeed, with a normal save file, we load it, and we see Doomguy with the weapon. Everything's fine. Now, if I modify the save file so that the next state becomes zero, when we load, we have Doomguy without a weapon. Okay, so this is already something that we can use. But we need to do that now on a MIPS CPU. And the MIPS CPU has the following address space. So what's important here is that any user space program can only be loaded in the lower 2 gigabytes of memory. So we can expect Pyrabom will load somewhere in this memory. The safe file is around 30 kilobytes in size, and we are not in control of everything. It still needs to be valid, so we cannot control all of it. But still, if we control all of it, and we would just try to use random indexes until the pointer of the state somehow points back to the safe file, this would be around 70,000 attempts to cover the full address space, which is too much. And on top of that, it's quite difficult to automate. But we have what files. So for example, the Doom1 WAT file is actually a file that contains other files. So every WAD is just a file container. For Doom1, it contains this PlayPal color map, E1, M1, E1, M2, and more files. And it's absolutely feasible and possible to just add our own data to a WAD. And I tried this until the Freebox would refuse to load Doom, and I reached a Doom1 WAD file of around 100 megabytes, which is consistent with the 128 megabytes of the Freebox HD. So the plan is to use the WAD files instead of the safe file for the data that we need to trigger the exploit. In particular, we will add a file in the WAD of 33 megabytes, which will contain the first crafted state T. We will add another file with the second crafted state T and the payload, which contains arbitrary code. And by doing this way, we are trying every time 33 megabytes of address space. So in 60 attempts, we should be done. But we can do even better. If we have a WAT file, which we fill with zeros, 100 megabytes of zeros, then we know that if somehow the modified state index in the safe file ends up pointing in this WAD, in the zero section, the weapon will not load. It could also be that, by chance, we are pointing to some other memory which contains zeros. But we can check that by also having a WAD which contains only garbage data. Because this time, if the modified state index ends up pointing in the garbage section, the game crashes. So by combining these two WADs, we have a way of telling for sure if a crafted index works by testing it first with the WAD which contains zeros, and then confirming that it was not by chance by testing it with the garbage WAD. This assumes that the heap is at a fixed address or has minimal variation, and in the end, with 100 megabytes, it doesn't really matter. So these are the results of my tests at the time, in a spreadsheet, of course. And at line 17, you see the first index that worked for me. So I tried it 5 times, and I was able every time to have no weapon display with the WAD which contains zeros, and to have a crash with the WAD which contains garbage data. So finally, I was able to construct an exploit that should work. I start by setting this index that I found in the save file. So this will affect the state pointer here and will make it point to the first part of the what file, which contains the first crafted state T. This then points to the second crafted state T, which points to the third one, which contains arbitrary code with a NOP sled, so 32 megabytes of NOP, and finally the exploit code. This should work in theory, assuming there is no NX protection on the MIPS CPU. So I decided to create the simplest exploit I could, and I had to do it by writing MIPS assembly. The goal of this exploit is to just create a file that I can then see using the FTP server. So MIPS assembly is quite complicated and quirky. Just this highlighted instruction is used to get the program counter value, so because the rest of the code is position independent. And you can see also that after every branch instruction, there's a NOP operation because MIPS always executes the instruction after a branch, even if the branch is taken. And then the rest of the exploit is just calling the create syscall with the file path that is displayed there. So then I connect to FTP, ls, and the file is there. It worked. No NX protection, so I was right to ignore this problem. And then I decided to start exploring, so I wrote a lot more MIPS assembly. And I found some interesting files, including a library to control the front panel display, and I thought I would make a more visual exploit. So in the first frame, this is me loading the save file of PRBoom, and then this happens. So it definitely works. Okay, so now it's time to explore a bit more. And immediately I realized that PRBoom is running in the sandbox, so it has a chroot. As user 4242, of course, there is almost nothing accessible. No nice file is there, no configuration, I can see almost nothing. One thing that is there is the shared memory. It's not mounted, there's no exec. So at least this lets me write proper C code instead of MIPS assembly, compile it as an ELF executable, and I wrote a loader, which lets me upload the program using FTP. It will copy it to DevSHM, set it as executable, and execute it. So this made my life much easier, but still no good results. Nothing useful is accessible. So the next step was to break out of the chroot jail. And how do we do that? Frankly, I had no idea, so I just Googled it. And it turns out it's pretty easy. It's even documented. There are tutorials. Two steps. The first one, be root. And the second one, just execute this magic sequence of mkdir, chdir, fchdir, chroot. OK, but I'm not root, so how can I become root when I'm not root? And I think you might know the answer already. I have to exploit local privilege escalation vulnerability in the Linux kernel. And of course, if there isn't one, I will have to find one myself. So the next step is to look at the list of LPs in the kernel. And really, there are very few, typically one every few years. The Freebox has all the latest fixes, so I have no choice but to find a new one. And the first entry point is the system calls, because you go directly from user space to kernel space, you control all the arguments, all the memory. It looks like a pretty nice way to find the vulnerability. But that's what everybody thinks, that's what everybody does. So this is scrutinized by too many people, and it's hardened so much that it was a dead end. So I kept thinking, well, what else could I do? And this is the connectivity of the Freebox HD. We have two USB ports here. We can plug in USB drives. So, file system vulnerabilities. So, the file system modules in Linux, they are just kernel modules, or they run directly in the kernel. And after looking at them for weeks, I can tell you that your USB drives, they don't really contain files. They contain untrusted data, and these kernel modules attempt to interpret that as files. So I had a new plan. If I can put a corrupted file system image on a USB drive, plug it into the Freebox HD, then I can get root. And of course, what's the first file system that anybody would look at for vulnerabilities? FAT32. But there are so many implementations of FAT32. Everyone is broken in one way or multiple ways that the Linux kernel module just is very, very hard about sanitizing this data. And as soon as something looks even a bit weird, the data is discarded. So it's really a dead end. So what's the other file system that consumers typically use when they have Apple devices, for example? HFS Plus. It's a bit more complex than FAT32, but it was promising. So we have to look quickly at how it works. It's really a lot of binary trees, and there is a catalog file which, as far as I understand, contains all the files. And the binary tree of these catalog files looks like this. And every index node or intermediate node is a directory, and every leaf node is a file. So now I'm going to jump straight to the bug, but this was the result of multiple weeks of looking at the code and trial and error. And here we have HFS plus readdir. So this function is called whenever we are enumerating files in a directory, for example, by doing ls. We see here there is a structure that's allocated on the stack. And this line here calls a function which finds a node in the catalog, the binary tree of the catalog, and puts the result in the FD variable. So after this function is called, the FD variable contains mostly control data, as in data coming from the USB drive. And a few lines later, we see that the same FD variable is used to read from the drive into this entry variable that's allocated on the stack. So here, we control entry offset and entry length. So we have a typical stack-based overflow, which is very nice because it means that we can, with a bit of luck, overwrite the return address and have the kernel call us back with kernel privileges. That is assuming there is no stack protection in the kernel. Again, I choose to ignore the problem and assume it's a MIPS CPU, so it's probably not there. So my new plan, I have this small program which will be loaded by my PRBoom loader. It has a main function which just opens a directory in the USB drive and then called getdents or getDirectoryEntries. And I used a special linker script for this program so that the main function would load at address 400,000 and the exploit callback function would load at address 600,000. And this is because my HFS plus oversized entry looks like this, so full of 600,000. And of course, this directory corresponds to the one on the USB drive, which contains this oversized entry. So the program should start in user mode. The main function calls getDirectoryEntries, which eventually calls HFS plus readdir, which triggers a stack overflow, which overrides the return address by the address where exploit callback is. And normally, this means that my function should be called with kernel privileges. Again, I tried to run the root exploit and have it create a file so I could check if it actually did something. And yes, the file appears, which is good, but it also means that it's not owned by root. So I need to try again. I need to call set UID 0 and retry. And I do that and, well, it's refused. And the reason for that is that while the exploit callback is called with kernel privileges, the Linux kernel still sees my process as run by user 4242. So the CPU is okay with me reading and writing anywhere, but the kernel is telling me, well, your UID is not zero, permission denied. So since the kernel is not collaborating, I'll have to set my UID to zero myself. And in order to do that, I need to know where this UID is. So let's have a look at the threads or processes. It's treated the same in the Linux. So in user mode, we have threads which are normally represented by a pthread T, but the kernel keeps track of the threads as task structs. And these task structs contains the credentials. I've put a quick snapshot of what a task struct looks like. So it's a big structure. And maybe you can see that what it contains depends a lot on how the kernel was compiled. So by just reading the source code, we cannot know what is the offset of the credential. We need to know how it was compiled. We could brute force this, but it's going to take a lot of attempts. And well, I can read anywhere, right? So I can just dump all the kernel memory. Then I try to find the function setuid in the kernel memory. So here it is. And by reading the disassembly, I can guess or even find the offset of the credentials in the task struct. Okay, now I need to find this task struct. Where is it in memory? And it turns out that in the MIPS implementation of Linux, as soon as a process enters kernel mode, the current task pointer is saved to the GP registers and stays like this until it leaves the kernel. So I can just read this register from my callback to know where the task struct is. In practice, so this is how setuid is implemented in user mode. So these are three lines highlighted there. The first one just reads the GP register, so we know where the task is. The second one gets the pointer to the credentials, and the third one sets the UID to zero. So in practice, being root does nothing in Linux except for accessing files owned by root. We need capabilities to really override the protections of the kernel. So that's what the next lines do in this exploit. They just enable all the capabilities for my thread. In particular, to escape the jail, I need capsys/chroot. Okay, so this is done. Does it work? Let's see the root file system before and after. Well, clearly. Clearly, it works. So the first thing I did was to look at the flash memory. And all the flash partitions are nicely mounted already. And I'm happy I didn't desolder it, because most of them are encrypted, and I would have been able to do nothing with that. Interestingly enough, we find some partitions named Xenv and Zboot, as we had in the bootlog by the team OpenFreebox. So let me give you a quick overview of the system. It's a custom Linux. It has a read-only root partition, and it runs BusyBox. There is no X server. Everything happens in the frame buffer. And the main user interface is a web browser, a frame buffer web browser, which is called Zen Browser. It has been since discontinued. There is an SSH server running. It's not OpenSSH. It is Dropbear, which is a lightweight implementation of SSH. We can find, of course, FTPD, PVRD, and other processes. And there are two users, which are root and Freebox. And well, you remember the OpenFreebox team? Can you guess what is the root password? Well, this is it. And that was slide 42. So when I saw that, I thought, OK, I have to connect to this SSH server as root. And it's a bit weird, because to access the FTP server on the Freebox HD, we connect to this IP address, which is a public IP address on the internet. So I assume that the Freebox server intercepts packets to this IP address and forwards them to the Flubox HD. So I tried to connect to SSH with this IP address and timeout. I tried to have a reverse shell so the Flubox HD would connect to my computer and nothing happens. So eventually I just run ifconfig on the Flubox HD and this is what I get. So there is no IP address on the ETH0 interface. Instead, we see that the VLAN 100 is used and the IP address is 192.168.27.1. By looking into it, I saw that there's also IPsec enabled. So there's really no way to access the network without knowing this. But let's try it. So we need VLAN 100. This is easy. We can just configure it on any computer. We need the keys from IPsec, and well, it's just not too complicated to get them once you're root, and there's this special file that just gives them. Good. And then there's something a bit special, this libfbx netwrap. It is a soft firewall, as in, for example, for Dropbear. Dropbear has to ask this library if an IP address is allowed to connect. So it's an opt-in firewall in a way. But it has a config file, and we see that in order to access the SSH server, we need to be in the 172.16/12 range. And another piece of information that I got using Wireshark is that when the Flubox HD boots, it's going to get its IP address from the server through a DHCP query, which happens before IPsec is set up. So this we can see in clear. With all that, I had my plan to access the Flubox using SSH. So I would boot it up, let it get its IP address from the Flubox server, and then I remove the Flubox server from the network. I replace it with a computer, which I call the gateway computer. I set it as VLAN 100 with the IP address of the Flubox server, IPsec setup, and I set up another VLAN, VLAN 70. With an IP address of 172.16.0.1 and IP forwarding enabled. My computer is going to connect to that gateway computer using the VLAN 70 with an IP address of 172.16.0.2. And this way, I have VLAN 100, IPsec, and libfbx netwrap is taken care of. So I try it, and well, it connects, but password is invalid, which is weird. I just read it from passwd. But, well, the plain text password in there, they are just jokes. Normally, hashes should be there. So no password can work at all. And only public key can work. So at this point, I just decided to take the Dropbear binary, patch it so any password would work. And finally, I have SSH access as root to the Flubox HD. Okay, so mission accomplished. Well, what about the recordings? That was the initial goal, right? So, PVRD, this binary contains all the symbols, so it's pretty easy to have a look at it. And I gave you a screenshot of a decompiled function. It reads a config file, and this config file decides if the recordings are private or public. And the config file, it lives on one of the two encrypted hard drive partitions, which is mounted, so I can just edit it in place with SSH. But I decided to get the keys just in case. And again, when you are root, this is pretty easy. You can just ask device mapper, which is responsible for mounting these partitions, well, what are the keys? And it will give you the keys. So this is for the sake of future proof. If I lose access, I can still access the partition by removing the hard drive. So in practice, we have here the configuration for TF1. We see that PVR mode is set to private. So we change it to public, try to have a recording, and we use FTP, and here it is, ready to be downloaded. So this time, mission accomplished. I know that some of you, because I did as well, might wonder, okay, there are URLs here for the streams. Can we access paid TV channels by modifying the URLs? And, well, first, you need to know that this RTSP server host resolves to the Freebox server. So the answer is, I don't know. I didn't dare to try it because probably there are more checks and I don't want to have someone on free get an alarm that this customer is accessing a TV channel that he's not paying for. So it might work, it might not work. Another interesting part is a custom HTTP server, it seems. At least I couldn't find any HTTP server with that name. It's called Cheyenne, and it provides a kind of RPC interface which is used, presumably, by the customer support. We can, for example, reboot the Freebox, show a message on the panel, and make the panel blink with test hotline. And I tested it on my Freebox. It works perfectly fine. And of course, I thought, does it work on other people's Freeboxes, right? So IPsec configuration. On the Freebox HD, it's configured in both transport and tunnel mode. So transport mode just encrypts the packets, but tunnel mode can be used to make a VPN in a way. And well, after looking at it for a while, I'm pretty sure of the following. The tunnel mode is used for communication with developers and customer support as well. So there are public keys of the developers in the SSH configuration of the Freeboxes, which means that developers can access them. Also, this is corroborated by the usage of the private IP range for the access to the SSH server. So I'm pretty sure with the right IPsec keys, it's possible to access any deployed Freebox. But again, I didn't dare to do that in the end. First, I'm not sure that the keys are global or are unique per Freebox. I don't know, and I didn't have a second Freebox to test. And second, well, it's one thing to play with a Freebox that's, okay, not mine, but at my home and disconnected from the network. It's another thing to, well, display a message on some random person's Freebox. So I thought this will probably remain forever a question that will not be answered. And honestly, I had done what I wanted, so I stopped there. I was scared of getting dragged into some problems. So an epilogue. The Freebox HD is quite old, but it's still in use. It's planned to be retired at the end of next year, I think. I tried to report the HFS Plus vulnerability, but I didn't have to because it was fixed 3 months after I discovered it. So I can just say this is not just a potential buffer overflow. And a funny thing is it was fixed 3 years before in HFS, which is not HFS Plus, right? So, okay. I've also contacted Free, and they are aware of all these vulnerabilities. I think they have been fixed. I cannot check, but they must have fixed them. And I think it's funny to see that for once the device was not hacked in order to run Doom on it, but because it runs Doom. And finally, so I gave back my Freebox HD in 2013, so already 12 years ago. And the months after I gave it back, Xavier Niel, the CEO of Free, he founded a new computer science school, which he called 42. So, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Frederic. Thank you for your amazing talk. Now it's time for questions. People from the stream can ask questions on Matrix in the Hall Zero, Hall Ground room, please, as well as on IRC, on hackint.org, on #39C3, minus Hall, minus Ground. The first question is from the chat, please.
Okay, dangerous question to ask, but the internet is wondering how much time you put in the research.
Well, I started in September of 2011, and I finished so in March of 2012. So not that much, but at the time I had nothing else to do.
Next question, microphone number 3, please.
Hi, great work, by the way. Just a quick question, why does it run Doom?
I think it runs Doom for the same reason that it has an FTP server. The developers at Free are probably geeks, and Free has always had this reputation of providing features for geeks. Like, for example, you were able to choose if your DSL should be in fastpass or interleaved mode, which I don't even know what it means, but it changes the ping. So this is not the kind of thing that you usually find with many ISPs. So I think they just thought it would be nice to have a box which runs Doom.
Thank you.
Next question, microphone number 2.
Okay, so what is the Freebox server? Amazing talk, by the way, sorry. Yeah.
The Freebox server, I haven't really looked into it. This one, first, it was not preventing me from doing anything, so I had no real reason to look into it. Also, I must say, I could have done it, but I was really getting scared because I know that if I look too much into it, I will end up doing something that I will regret. And again, the main reason is that it's not my device, and the Freebox server cannot really be disconnected from the network and remain useful, so experimenting with it can get dangerous.
Fair enough.
Microphone number 4, please.
Hello. I'm a bit surprised that you had to rely on a kernel exploit. Did you try the obvious, like, you know, plugging a Linux file system with setuid binaries or, you know, leak handled in a process or stuff like that?
Yeah, so I tried a few things and none of them works because everything that is mounted with no SUID, no exec, no nothing. So it's quite well secured on this part.
Microphone number 3, please.
Thank you very much for hacking a device that I had at home when I was a child but couldn't touch yet. It's very interesting for me to see. As a former 42 student and long-time Free user, I'm wondering how the disclosure procedure went and if you got any bug bounty out of it.
Okay, so, first I kept that to myself for a long time because then if it's not disclosed, it keeps working. Right. And then again, I was scared of how they could react. And I really only contacted them when this talk was accepted, because I preferred for them to know in advance than to discover this, especially in the Christmas holiday season. And they were very nice. They immediately acknowledged the problem, wanted to talk with me. I gave them the commit to apply in the kernel to fix the HFS Plus vulnerability. So PRBoom is not maintained anymore and hasn't been in almost 20 years, so there is no patch there. But I gave them the two lines to check the index. And I think I could have told them without any issue much earlier. But they just reacted as I would expect from Free, which is they welcome the research done. There was no bug bounty because, I think there is just none at Free. So, I did this for no money in the end.
Microphone number 2.
I had another question. In the remote control scripts, that stood out to me a lot because it looks like Lua, the programming language.
Yes.
How does the remote control feature work at a high level?
So this web server, which is custom, has a Lua runtime, and it loads some Lua files, which provides some RPC. And there is another, there is a file, a CGI file, that ends up allowing execution of functions that are in these Lua modules. I didn't really look into how exactly it works. I just tried it and it worked. So,
thank you.
Microphone number 4.
Any idea why Free kept this particular device around for so many years, especially compared to other setup boxes that retire after like 3 years?
I think it's been a long time since it's not possible to get one anymore. But one of the reasons is that at some point, Free bought another ISP, which was called Alice ADSL at the time. and it was a bit cheaper than the free subscription, and you had no choice but to get this Freebox V5 and the Freebox HD. And some people just like what they have and don't want to change, and I guess these are the people who still have this box at home. But no matter what, they are going to replace it end of next year, if I have understood correctly.
Thanks.
One more question from the internet.
Yes, the internet wonders, have you looked into the newer free boxes, if you can do something with them?
So, right now, let's say free is still my ASP, and I have a newer free box. I prefer not to say, but let's say I really need my internet access to remain up at the time, so I prefer not to say.
Okay, any last question? Thanks a lot, Frédéric, for this amazing talk. A last warm round of applause, please. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you.